Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we have been studying the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. This is Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 140, the exposition of the elements. And now we're at the point in the sutta where the Buddha has been giving a discourse to the wandering monk named Pukkusati. This is a monk who has gone forth out of faith in the Buddha, but he had never seen the Buddha before. And he had met the Buddha in the course of his wandering. He had met the Buddha in this potter's shed, and the Buddha engaged him in conversation, but without revealing his own identity. And then the Buddha started to give him some explanation or of the teaching, but without revealing to him that he is the Buddha. And this young man is listening to him. And now the Buddha is explaining the step-by-step process by which the meditating monk contemplates for the development of wisdom in order to reach liberation. And the Buddha has been basing this exposition on the theme of the six elements. He's gone through first the contemplation of the five material elements, earth, water, fire, and air elements, then the space element, then he came to the consciousness element, which he's explained interestingly by way of the investigation of feelings. Then he comes to the point where there remains only equanimity. Now, I went through this whole passage last week. I went through it rather quickly, and so I want to go back and go through it a little more slowly, and to draw out its implications. Okay, so after, in the Buddha's exposition, as the meditator is observing how each of the three types of feeling arises based on its own type of contact, and then ceases with the cessation of that contact, eventually there becomes established in his mind the state of equanimity, which is described as purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. And the commentary identifies this as the equanimity of the fourth jhana, the fourth meditative absorption. Now, it seems to me that there's a little ambiguity here, because this equanimity is developing through the contemplation of feeling. So it seems that this is a kind of equanimity which develops based on an insight contemplation, not simply through the development of jhana. And yet, later, the Buddha will say that the meditator directs this equanimity to the attainment of the formless meditations. And the formless meditations are the states of absorption that lie above the fourth jhana. And so there seems to be some justification for saying that this is the equanimity of the fourth jhana. What we might suppose is that the meditator has previously attained the fourth jhana, then based on the fourth jhana, he's used it for contemplating the nature of feelings, how feelings have arisen, how feelings arise based on their corresponding types of contacts. And now he understands that he can take this equanimity of the fourth jhana, and direct it further to the formless attainments, if he wanted to. And so, in paragraph 21, the Buddha says, this is the way the meditator understands, if I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite space and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mine, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. Yeah, key expression here. Key phrase in the description of this equanimity in Pali. Describing this equanimity is the phrase supported by that base and clinging to it. The word nisita means dependent upon or supported by, and upadana is clinging. Okay, so in this case, this equanimity would be attached to that base of infinite space, and it would be clinging to it. And then through clinging to it, it would remain for a very long time. What this means is that the meditator, through this subtle clinging, would be able to take rebirth through that meditative attainment in the base of infinite space, the realm of infinite space. And then the mind would remain in that realm of existence for a very long time, which, according to the text, could be something like 20,000 cosmic cycles, 20,000 kalpas. But one could go even further, and one could direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite consciousness. And then, if one were to develop one's mind accordingly, then this equanimity of the base of infinite consciousness, supported by it and clinging to it, would then get directed to rebirth in the realm of infinite consciousness. That's one of the second realm of formless existence, and would remain there for a very long time. That's said to be 40,000 aeons, 40,000 cosmic cycles, 40,000 kalpas. But one might go further and then develop that equanimity still higher to the third level, which is called the base of nothingness. And then if one develops one's mind accordingly, then that equanimity, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. That is, the mind that has mastered this meditation of the base of nothingness develops the power to take rebirth in the realm of nothingness. That's the third level of formless existence, and can remain there for a very long time. That's a state of pure quietude, where it seems that there's just no obstruction or no impediment. And it remains there, it's said, for 60,000 kalpas, 60,000 cosmic cycles. But one can still go further and develop that equanimity to a still higher level, the level of the fourth formless attainment. This is called the base of neither perception nor non-perception, neva sanyana sanyayatanam. And when the equanimity is developed to that level and the mind is developed accordingly, then the mind becomes empowered to take rebirth at the level of the fourth formless attainment. This is the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. And when one takes rebirth in this fourth formless realm, then one can remain there, it's said, for 84,000 cosmic cycles. Why they don't say simply 80,000, why it jumps up to 84,000, I don't know. Maybe because you make the fourth level, maybe you get an extra 4,000 cosmic aeons as a bonus. A special incentive for not remaining satisfied with the third level. So you can go over to the next counter and you get a special ticket entitling you to remain another 4,000 cosmic cycles. If you don't go over to that table and get the ticket, then you only get 80,000 cycles. So if somebody calls you at the end of 80,000 cycles and says you have to go down, and you point to the others who are still staying up there and say, why are they staying up but I have to go down? Then the boss says, do you have your extra bonus ticket? You say, no. And then he'll say, well, you forgot to pick it up at the table when you were meditating down at Earth, so we can't help you now. Okay, so in this paragraph, it seems that the Buddha is praising this equanimity. He's showing the excellence of it, because he's showing that one who develops this equanimity, which is purified and bright, is able to direct it to these very exalted levels, and by developing the mind accordingly can remain there for such long periods of time. And so in this way he's extolling this monk Pukkusati, who's already developed the fourth jhana, who's already gained that equanimity. But the Buddha has also shown a subtle danger in this equanimity, which is, or at least he's shown a subtle danger in the attainments based on that equanimity, which is that when one directs this equanimity in that way, that equanimity is something which is being, which one is basing oneself upon, which one is being supported by, and which one is clinging to. And so there's some kind of clinging which is underlying that equanimity and the attainments that arise out of it. And now of these four attainments that are mentioned here, these were the attainments which the Buddha himself, before his enlightenment, when he was still a bodhisattva seeking the way to enlightenment, he had actually reached these attainments under his early meditation teachers. Under the teacher Alara Kalama, he learned the method for reaching the third formless attainment, the base of nothingness. And under the other teacher, Uttaka Ramaputta, he learned the method for reaching the fourth attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And yet, though he reached both of these attainments, he wasn't satisfied with them. And he realized that these attainments don't lead to supreme enlightenment, that they don't bring liberation. And so now, in the next paragraph, the Buddha is going to show the defect or danger in these meditative attainments. And he does this just by mentioning one word. He says in paragraph 22, he says, if I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite space and to develop my mind accordingly, this would be conditioned. Here the key word is the word saṅkataṃ. This would be conditioned. And similarly, if I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite consciousness, to the base of nothingness, to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and to develop my mind accordingly, this would be conditioned. But then the note number 1277, I read it last week, I won't read it again, but this is the note passage from the commentary which draws out the implications of this word conditioned. Whatever is conditioned is subject to birth, aging, and death, is bound up with limitations, and is not capable of bringing final liberation. And so then there comes the next sentence, which shows what the meditator does. And that's very significant, the actual wording of the Pali text. Let me just get it. Anabhisankaranto, anabhisanchetayanto. You see that first verb, the participle, anabhisankaranto, which means that he doesn't create any new conditions. Here it's translated, he doesn't form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being, either tending towards either renewed existence, continued existence, or towards annihilation, non-existence. And now this passage, or that statement, ties up with a little sutta that comes in Itivutaka, a little collection from the Kutaka Nikaya. Here the Buddha speaks about how living beings are held in bondage by two kinds of views. He says, some hold back and some go too far, and only those with vision see. Okay, how do some hold back? Some remain fixed. He says, most beings enjoy existence, delight in existence, and are satisfied in existence. And so when the Dhamma is taught for liberation from existence, then their minds do not settle upon it and become resolved upon it. So it is in this way that some hold back. So this is the great majority are attached to continued individual existence. So that is the way most people are forming volitions which tend towards existence or being, even if it's not towards just the enjoyment of pleasures, but even the subtle philosophers and meditators aspire for some kind of divine existence or celestial existence. But then how do some overreach or go too far? Here the Buddha says, there are some who are troubled, ashamed and disgusted by existence, and they rejoice in the idea of non-existence, saying, when the self with the breakup of the body is annihilated and destroyed and does not exist after death, this is peaceful, this is excellent, this is the real. That is how some go too far. And how is it that those with vision see? Here, one sees what has come to be as having come to be, and having seen it thus, one practices the way for disenchantment, for dispassion, for the cessation of what has come to be. It is in this way that those with vision see. Okay, so in this case, which is being described in the exposition of the elements, the meditator here will not be forming any kind of aspiration for eternal existence and not be forming any wish for the annihilation of a assumed self, but instead he'll be examining this process of arising and passing away. seeing how phenomena arise through conditions and cease through conditions. And then through seeing the arising and passing away of phenomena, there comes the insight into impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness. And through this insight into this nature of things, this clinging to the phenomena of the world is removed. And so that's what's meant when it says he does not cling to anything in this world. And not clinging is na upadeyati, not clinging, is the negation of that clinging that can underlie this purified equanimity. So instead of holding to the equanimity, this purified equanimity of the meditative attainment, instead of holding to it and clinging to it, even with a subtle clinging, when one sees the equanimity as something which is impermanent, selfless phenomena, then the clinging to it falls away. And with the falling away of the clinging, then the craving falls away. The falling of the way of the craving is what is indicated by the phrase, he is not agitated. Naparitasati. It really means he stops craving, that there's no more craving. And when that craving completely stops, then pachatang yeva parinibhayati. He personally or inwardly attains nibbana. And he understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. Okay, the next two paragraphs are describing the relationship of the arahant to feeling. So now, with this paragraph that I just finished, this is describing the attainment of arahantship. And so with paragraph 23 now, we start describing the inner experience of the arhant. And this is done again in relation to feeling. And so when whatever feeling an arhant experiences, whether it be pleasant feeling, painful feeling, or feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant, the arhant understands this feeling is impermanent. There is no holding or clinging to it. And there is no delight in it. When he feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it detached from it. Similarly, when he feels a painful feeling, when he feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Then when he experiences a feeling terminating with the body, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with the body. And when he experiences a feeling terminating with life, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with life. And the way I understand this is that the arhat understands that he will continue to feel or experience these feelings as long as the body subsists and as long as life continues. But then he understands that on the dissolution of the body, with the ending of life, all that is felt, all feeling, not being delighted in, taking no delight in any feelings, will become cool right here. That is, that all feelings will come to an end. And since feelings are considered some kind of disturbance, whether they're pleasant, painful, or neutral, this is described as a kind of cooling down of all feelings. And then this is illustrated with a simile of an oil lamp. That just as an oil lamp burns in dependence on oil and a wick, when the oil and wick are used up, if it doesn't get any more fuel, then it is extinguished from lack of fuel. So too, well, and this, the simile is just filled out, when the arhat feels a feeling terminating with the body, terminating with life, he understands, I feel a feeling terminating with life, and he understands that on the dissolution of the body, with the ending of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. Okay, now with paragraph 25, the Buddha is going to complete the exposition, because through this whole sequence dealing with the contemplation of the elements up to the end of paragraph 24, he was explaining how one fulfills the foundation of wisdom. And this was the first of the four foundations. And so now the Buddha has been elaborating on the four foundations. And so this whole body of the sutta that we've been treating in the last two classes has just been an elaboration of the foundation of wisdom. So he says, a bhikkhu, a monk possessing this wisdom, possesses the supreme foundation of wisdom. For this is the supreme noble wisdom, the Paramarya Panya, namely the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. Yeah, esahi bhikkhu parama arya panya yadidang sabadukha kaye jnanam. Okay, then we come to the supreme foundation of truth. And you see, here we should emphasize, like, all along the Buddha has been explaining the foundation of wisdom, the panya adhitana, the foundation of wisdom. And now with this paragraph, the Buddha is showing what is the supreme or the ultimate foundation of wisdom. And that is the wisdom through which one understands the destruction of all suffering. This is the knowledge which knows that within oneself all suffering, all dukkha, has been destroyed. Okay, and now we come to the exposition of the supreme foundation of truth. Okay, now the Buddha says his deliverance, that is his liberation, is founded upon truth. This is not just a temporary liberation, a liberation that has been achieved just through success in a meditative attainment, but then can fall away. But this is a liberation that's been achieved through realization of truth. So this liberation is unshakable. And now comes a very important statement. The Buddha says, for that is false, which has a deceptive nature. Anything that is capable of giving rise to deception is ultimately false. But that is true, which has an undeceptive nature. And that which is completely undeceptive in its nature is Nibbana. And so a monk who possesses this truth possesses the supreme foundation of truth. For the Buddha says, this is the supreme noble truth, the paramang arya satyam, namely Nibbana, which has an undeceptive nature. Now comes the third foundation. This is called the foundation of relinquishment, the chaga adhitana. Chaga, in one sense, means giving or generosity, but in another sense it means giving up or relinquishment. And here it's being used in that second sense. And it's being contrasted with things that are called upadhi. Upadhi are things that one acquires, things that one possesses. They could be material possessions, they could be In the deeper sense, though, upadhi is taken to mean the five aggregates, since those are the acquisitions that we identify with as being the constituents of ourself. And also the acquisitions are the defilements, especially craving, that through which we acquire things. Okay, so the Buddha says that when he was ignorant, he took up and grasped hold of acquisitions. But now, with craving all removed, now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this relinquishment possesses the supreme foundation of relinquishment. For this is the supreme noble relinquishment, namely the relinquishing of all acquisitions. That is, the giving up not simply of material things, but the giving up of all inner defilements and then of attachment to one's own five aggregates, which are the basis of birth, aging, and death. Okay, then continuing, now the Buddha will come to what is called the foundation of peace. And he says, formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced covetous, desire, and lust. Those are three terms which are really synonymous. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, and so on. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced anger, ill will, and hatred. Again, these are three terms, more or less synonymous. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump. Okay, formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced ignorance and delusion. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, and so on. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this peace, this is upasama, possesses the supreme foundation of peace. For this is the supreme noble peace, namely the pacification, the appeasement, the calming down of lust, hate, and delusion. Okay, so now the Buddha ties up that saying, which was one of the sayings that he introduced at the beginning of the sutta. So he said, he says, so it was with reference to this that it was said, one should not neglect wisdom, one should preserve truth, one should cultivate relinquishment, and one should train for peace. When the Buddha said that at the beginning of the sutta, he indicated that those are the beginning stages that one should start to cultivate. Those are the initial points of cultivation, wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. But when those beginning points are cultivated, they grow and mature until they culminate in this supreme noble wisdom, the supreme noble truth, the supreme relinquishment, and the supreme noble peace. And then the last part of the opening statement that the Buddha made when he first started speaking with Pukkhusati. That was in paragraph 7. Now he brings it in here again. He says, the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called Muni Santo, a sage at peace. So it was said, and with reference to what was the said. Now the Buddha is going to elaborate on the meaning. And here in the original saying, the sutta uses a very unusual expression that I think occurs only in this sutta, manyusava, which I don't remember whether it was Jnanamoli who used this or whether I had introduced this. For translating this, the tides of conceit. But it's, manya is like conceiving. Yeah, the tides of conceiving. Usava is something like swelling up, swelling or rising up. And manya is conceiving. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain what is meant by this conceiving. By a conceiving is meant a false idea, a false imagining. And so what are these false imaginings? So here in paragraph 31 he says, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. First, I am, this is, you could say, the root delusion, the idea that I exist at all, that there is some kind of really existing I at the center of my being, some kind of truly existing self. Then from this idea of a truly existing self, with I am this, one tries to find some identity for that self, to identify it with form, feeling, perception, formations, consciousness, to give it some content. Then I shall be, that is the view of eternalism. I will exist forever. I will exist after death. I shall not be. This is the view of annihilationism, the view that self will come to an end at death. I shall be possessed of form, I shall be formless. Two different eternalist views. I shall be percipient, I shall be non-percipient. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient. Those are three different eternalist views. Then the Buddha says, conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a dart. By overcoming all conceivings, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. He is not shaken. And then you have to change this. This was a mistake on the part of Wisdom Publications, not putting in my correction correctly. He is not shaken and does not yearn. That's the way it should be. And does not yearn. For there is nothing present in him by which he might be born. What is not present in him is any craving for further existence that leads back to new birth. Not being born, how could he age? How could he grow old? Not aging, how could he die? Not dying, how could he be shaken? Not being shaken, why should he yearn? So it was reference to this, with reference to this, that it was said, the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. Then the Buddha says, Bhikkhu, bear in mind this brief exposition of the six elements. And meanwhile, probably even quite a while ago, Pukkusati had already realized that the only one who could give such a discourse like that is the Buddha. But here the text says, thereupon, it says, attako, then, but probably Pukkusati was already aware of this quite some time ago. that he thinks, indeed, the teacher has come to me, the Sublime One, the Buddha, has come to me. Then he got up and he arranged his robe in a formal way, and he bowed down at the Buddha's feet, and he apologized for his error. This is a stock formula. He says, the transgression overcame me, and that, like a fool, confused and blundering, I presumed to address the Blessed One as friend. He was just calling him Avuso, which is an address used between equals, rather than calling him Bhante. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive me my transgression, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future. Okay, then the Buddha says, indeed a transgression overcame you. Again, this is stock formula. But then the Buddha says, since you see your transgression as such, we forgive you. This is growth in the Noble One's discipline. When one sees one's transgression as such, makes amends in accordance with the Dhamma, and undertakes restraint in the future. Then Pukkhasati asked to receive the Upasampada. This is the full admission, full ordination under the Buddha. And when he asked for this, this seems to imply that he earlier had received the lower ordination or novice ordination, Samanera ordination. Though the explanation in the commentary says simply that he didn't receive any ordination, formal ordination, but he had just put on the robe out of faith in the Buddha and had gone forth as one who has gone forth without any ordination, but as an unordained ascetic. But this statement seems to suggest that he had already had the lower ordination, which can be given just by one other monk, but to receive the full ordination, it has to be given by a sangha, that is, by a community of monks. And so he might have gotten the lower ordination, the novice ordination, just from one monk, but he couldn't find a full community to give the full ordination. And now the Buddha asks him whether he has his complete set of robes and bowl. He must have had a bowl because he would have been living on alms round, going from town to town to collect his alms. But probably he didn't have the full set of robes required for the full ordination. And so the Buddha says that, he says that my bowl and robes are not complete, probably meaning that he doesn't have the full set of three monastic robes. And so the Buddha says that he won't give the full admission to anyone who doesn't have the bowl and robes complete. Okay, so then Pukkhasati, after paying homage to the Buddha, he goes out in order to search for a bowl and robes. And then while he is searching for a bowl and robes, a stray cow killed him. And now, according to the commentary, gives some information on this. And as I said several times, sometimes one can believe the stories in the commentary, sometimes one doesn't know whether they are just fables which are introduced for entertainment or because they're interesting. But it says that, actually, this is actually said elsewhere, that Pukkhasati was part, in an earlier life, there was a group of monks under a previous Buddha who had gone up to the top of a mountain with a ladder, and they kicked off the ladder, saying that they were not going to go down to beg for food, but they were determined that they were going to reach arhatship with psychic powers on that mountain. And those who got arhatship with psychic powers would be able to fly off the mountain and go down, and those who didn't get arhatship with psychic powers would perish on the mountain. A couple of them did gain arhatship with psychic powers and were able to fly off the mountain, but Pukkusati was one of that group who didn't survive, who perished on the mountain. And it said that there were several in that group who had, in some way, had been involved with killing some being in an earlier life. And that being was now reborn as a yaksha. And that yaksha was going to get revenge on them. And each time it took the form of a cow and would kill them at a decisive point in their life. And one of the members of that group was Pukkusati. And so Pukkusati was now to be killed, just at the point when he was about to get full ordination as a monk. Okay, so Pukkusati was killed. So you could read it at that level. If one doesn't like to believe these stories, one could just read it at a more common sense level, that as he was walking down the street, some ferocious cow killed him. Okay, so after he is killed, a number of monks come up to the Buddha and they pay homage to him. And then obviously they've heard about the Buddha giving him this brief instruction. It's actually quite elaborate instruction. And then they ask, what is the destiny of Pukkusati? What is his future course? And then the Buddha says that this clansman, Pukkusati, was wise. He practiced in accordance with the Dhamma and did not trouble me in the interpretation of the Dhamma. With the destruction of the five lower fetters, the clansman Pukkusati has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes, and he will attain final nibbana there without ever returning from that world. So apparently, while that discourse was being given by the Buddha, or perhaps shortly thereafter, probably during the course of the discourse, Pukkusati achieved the stage of non-returner. And there is a sutta in Saṅyutta Nikāya. This is Saṅyutta Nikāya, first chapter, I think it's sutta number 50. It's called the Gatikāra Sutta, in which a deva named Gatikāra comes to the Buddha and tells the Buddha that this clansman Pukkusati had just been reborn in one of the realms in the pure abodes, and very soon after reaching rebirth in that realm, he cut through all of the remaining fetters and he achieved arhatship in that realm. Okay, so this will be the end of the exposition of the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta. If there's any questions, then...
What does this last statement mean? He practiced in accordance with the Dhamma and did not trouble me in the interpretation.
I think that's a little free. I think just... we could simply translate it, he didn't trouble me on account of the Dhamma. I don't actually know the implications of it. There could be a case of sometimes monks come to the Buddha and argue with him about the Dhamma. Sometimes they develop their own theories and views and try to propose those to the Buddha as being the correct interpretation. But I don't know any text that gives a formal explanation of that expression. Okay, George?
The paragraph 20 where they talk about equanimity, purified and bright.
Yeah.
That phrasing is very much like the description of the mind in the fourth jhana.
Yeah, I think I pointed that. I think I did.
Should I just interpret equanimity as mind?
Equanimity is?
As mind, is it equivalent?
Equanimity is not the equivalent of mind. No, but the equanimity is a factor of mind. And so we could say that the description of the mind in the fourth jhana also applies to this equanimity. Just as the mind is pure and bright in the fourth jhana, so that equanimity is pure and bright. But you can't just make an equivalence between equanimity and mind. They're not the same. Yes?
Paragraph 22. I'm not sure I follow the transition that's going on here, because this is the one where he's talking about the warnings of the danger.
Yeah.
Of that it's conditioned. And then the very next sentence is, so he's saying to all of these aspects of the formless realms that they would be conditioned. And then the next sentence, he does not form any condition. So is he just going from the, okay, well, that's bad, and now, okay, so now don't form any condition? I mean, how is he going from one to the other? I'm missing that transition. Because it seems that he's in the base of the fourth base of the formless realm, and all of a sudden now he's moving into nirvana, and I'm missing the transition.
He's not actually in the fourth. He's not actually in the fourth formless attainment. But he knows, he understands that if he were to direct this equanimity, pure and bright, to any of these formless attainments, and to develop his mind accordingly, he understands that this would be conditioned. And so when he understands it in this way, then he sees that this is a defective state, that this is not worth developing, because this would be a conditioned state if I were to develop my mind in this way. This conditioned state would eventually wear out. It's impermanent. It's still within the realm of birth, aging, and death. And so for this reason, instead of directing his mind in that way, he instead directs it, instead of forming conditions and generating volitions towards the attainment of that, those formless realms. Instead, he would develop the insight into understanding the nature of these meditative attainments. And the understanding through insight of the nature of those meditative attainments brings about, you might call their dismantling, the deconditioning process, the undoing of the conditioning process. And that brings the removal of clinging, the deactivation of craving, and then the attainment of nibbana. Pretty much that is actually what the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. And what differed from the type of meditative practices that he was doing when he was practicing under the guidance of those early meditation teachers. Any further questions? Okay, maybe next time we'll do, it's not on the original list, but I'll add this. The Mula Pariyaya Sutta, Sutta number 1. Because it ties up with the theme of conceiving.
Question. In paragraph 22, he goes over all these different exalted states.
Yeah.
It's all conditional. And I can see how that would lead towards not wanting to feel any volition towards being. But it would seem that if you examined all the states of being and concluded they're all conditioned, you would then say, okay, well, I guess non-being is the way to go. I'm not sure how it... How do you conclude that, you know, that you shouldn't create a volition towards non-being based on these reflections? Any other explanations I've heard about the problem of wanting non-being is that it's tied up with the conceit I am.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that ties into this particular reflection.
There are actually forms of the annihilationist view that posit a subtle kind of self that is to be realized through gaining the formless attainments. And then it's only when one gains that formless attainment that one is able to completely annihilate the self. They're mentioned in the Brahmajala Sutta. I have to say, I don't clearly understand them. But the Brahmajala Sutta mentions 7 types of annihilationist view. And usually when we think of the annihilationist view, we think of it as simply the view that when this physical body perishes, that it means that the self is perished. But the Brahmajala Sutta mentions a view that there are certain subtle kinds of self, and one is the self connected to this physical, gross physical body. Then the 4 highest types of annihilationist view are views that posit a self connected to the 4 formless attainments, and that it's when one gains these 4 formless attainments that this self becomes annihilated and destroyed. So it seems that this must be referring to those elements of the self that are realized through the formless attainments. That's the only way I might understand it.
Right, so by non-being, it's referring to a particular type of annihilationism.
That's what I would think. Okay, so let us end with sharing of the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumotipa chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumotipa chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumotipa chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.